This event is presented by the Council on Foreign Relations.
Welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations and our topic today, social justice movements and Twitter, digital revolutions at home and abroad. Thank you for joining us. I'm Catherine Powell, an adjunct senior fellow with the Women in Foreign Policy program and the Digital and Cyberspace program. It's my honor to introduce our two speakers today. Brooke Foucault-Wells, co-author of Hashtag Activism, Networks of Race and Gender Justice, and CFR's very own Megan Stone, author, co-author of the book Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights, which Megan co-authored with Women in Foreign Policy Senior Director Rachel Vogelstein. A longer version of their accomplishments is included in the packet. Let me start by saying that what led me to today's topic was my own recognition of the power of social media when I worked in the Obama White House. I worked there during the Arab Spring, summer, and fall. And the day I interviewed for my job at the National Security Council with Senior Director Samantha Power, initially rescheduled for noon, but President Mubarak was toppled that day in Egypt. Our interview got pushed back to 6 p.m. Friday night. During what was practically my first week of work in the White House, I was told that Syria had shut down the internet. Egypt had done the same. I was at a farewell party, a cocktail party in the old executive office building, and we all immediately sprang into action to get our principals to sign off on what the US reaction should be to this suppression of the ability of protesters to use social media, to organize, to speak out. 2 years earlier, Twitter was the social media vehicle of choice for protesters in Iran's Velvet Revolution. The death of one woman went viral. Twitter was scheduled for a maintenance shutdown, a temporary maintenance shutdown. And my colleague, Jared Cohen, who some of you know, he's a colleague here at CFR. Jared contacted the head of Twitter and said, you know what, you can't shut down Twitter because it's the way people are organizing on the street to speak out against the stolen election in Iran. Well, needless to say, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was not that thrilled and contacted the White House to express his discontent. When the president spoke with the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, she said, you know what, Jared did exactly the right thing. We're standing up for free speech. Jared describes that story as one of the three times he was almost fired doing the right thing. Well, in today's talk, our two speakers will provide opening remarks about today's topic, and then I'll ask a few questions before we open it up to our broader audience, since many of you have various forms of critical expertise in this area. First, Brooke, let me begin with you, with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Catherine. Thanks for organizing this conversation. It's a delight to be with all of you, even if we can't yet be safely in the same room, although hopefully soon. So as Catherine mentioned, I am one of the co-authors of a book called Hashtag Activism, Networks of Race and Gender Justice, which I wrote with my fabulous collaborators, Sarah Jackson and Moya Bailey. We worked together on this book because we were particularly interested in how marginalized people and communities could use social media in order to create the kinds of transformative change that Catherine alluded to. Our book focuses primarily on instances of activism in the United States. So most notably, Black Lives Matter and Me Too. Although there are dozens, if not hundreds, of other hashtags that we explore in the book and examine for the ways that they connect, particularly with the mainstream media. Our focus is really on race and gender justice. And part of what we aim to do with the book is not to contradict the prevailing wisdom coming from Black and feminist communities. We wholeheartedly and full-throatedly endorse the work of folks like Sophia Noble and Timi Gebru, who levied very appropriate critiques on some of the limitations of social media in particular for people of color, women, and so on. At the same time, our personal experience of those platforms is that they weren't always tools of oppression, that there were these pathways to come together and draw attention either to issues that folks cared about that weren't being covered, or to issues that were being covered, but weren't being covered in the ways that felt authentic and appropriate to the people being affected. So we use a mixed methods approach in the book. We center our work on Twitter. It's both more accessible from a data standpoint, which is something we could dig into in the Q&A, and also the place where both politicians and media makers tend to go for interaction with constituents or potential story leads. So in that way, it has this outsized impact on public dialogue, which at the end of the day is really what we are interested in. Using this mixed methods approach, so I'm a network scientist, and I do quantitative large-scale computational network analyses. My job is to kind of take an empirical look at the data and draw out important patterns, things for further investigation. My co-authors are critical race and gender scholars, and they focus more deeply on how meaning is being made in those important, sort of mathematically important sections of these networks. By combining these methods, we were able to track not only what was important, but why it was important. So we looked at things like how social media can be used to change positions vis-a-vis power, how social media can be used to transform the public sphere. So what the general public thinks is important or what they think about the things that are important. And then finally, we connect some dots between what activists on social media are doing and what the mainstream media is covering. Now, I don't want to oversell the optimism of this book. Obviously, social media still has its limits. Obviously, there are still power dynamics to work with. But ultimately, I think the central thesis of our book is that social media can be this transformative opportunity to inject new narratives or to change the narratives in the way that we talk about things. And in that way, it is new, of course, because the technology is new, but it's quite familiar. So it sits alongside hundreds of years of media-based activism that we can date all the way back to Enlightenment era philosophers using the printed book in order to get different than radical ideas out into circulation. So we trace the kind of history of that up to the contemporary moment where we can see really rapid and radical changes happening, at least in part because of these networks online.
Terrific. Okay, I'm going to want to circle back with you about sort of the history, the evolution of social media, going back to thinking of the play Hamilton when, you know, they're handing out those little playbills, but, you know, and eventually it becomes the Federalist Papers, right? But how it's evolved. So, Megan, let's go to you. And I'm so happy to have you back at CFR.
I'm so happy to be here. You're one of my first among equals colleagues, so it's always a privilege when I hear from you. And I'm so grateful for your voice and your work and your perspective at this organization and institution. So thank you. It's an honor. And it's an honor to be here with Brooke too and everyone that's joining us today. You know, our book, Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights, that I co-authored with Rachel Vogelstein here at CFR at the Women in Foreign Policy Program, is coming out July 13th. And I am not an esteemed academic like Brooke with her incredible credentials. I've spent a lot of time instead out in the field working with human rights activists and particularly with girls and women who are human rights defenders. You know, and there's this very outdated idea about what essentially women in developing countries are doing in terms of technology. You know, there's a real gender gap in terms of uptake of tech. That's real. But what we're finding is that, of course, women in these countries, and especially generationally, are using these tools to organize. And, you know, if you want to meet some people with raw hustle, like hang out with women human rights defenders, because they're going to use every avenue they can to try to come together and organize, right? So, you know, it also came out of just talking to even some well-meaning male colleagues about questions about what is the Me Too movement really, you know, gained for women, you know, and for us, the book was really about chronicling the women all over the world who are winning really concrete legal, economic, and political wins. You know, I think there's some sense in a generalized way that if a few high-level men in the United States do or don't pay consequences, many have in a high-level way, others seem to be evading lately, you know, that's the success of this movement. And that is yet again, you know, putting the focus on the wrong folks, right? So for us, we wanted to catalog what was happening outside the United States. You know, these are hashtags that you may not be aware of them trending because you don't speak Urdu. You know, you may not be familiar with what's happening with, you know, campaigns like in the north of Nigeria, like Ariwa Me Too, right? So Ariwa is just the Hausa word for north, you know, and there's incredible women activists there, like Fikria Hashem, who is a young woman in her 20s, who somehow, you know, despite the threat of Boko Haram and her community, came together with other women to organize around Me Too and try to shine a bright light around what was happening. That for them had a very direct link to a legal or policy outcome, and that they wanted to start changing a law around women's rights in the workplace and in terms of sexual assault and harassment, to then be put on the books in all of Nigeria. And of course, because it's a system of many states, each state parliament has to pass that law, and they wanted to see these laws passed. You know, it was the Violence Against Persons Act that they were fighting to pass. So, you know, these are really concrete tools and wins that, you know, women are trying to create to further their legal, economic, and political equality. And I think sometimes this very glib hashtag activism kind of stance really misses what's happening, you know. And so for us, it was really going out and getting both the qualitative storytelling and the quantitative numbers about, you know, if you really do the deep work of looking in specific localized languages, what's happening. And if you actually take the time to do the research, you know, what laws are changing, you know, and we found women were winning first ever legal victories. They were spurred by the movement and what's been happening with women's rights organizing online to run for office for the first time. Even in places like Brazil, where women like Marielle Franco were assassinated, you know, an incredible Afro-Brazilian LGBT woman leader, even that going out over social media inspired many more women to run for office themselves. So, you know, sometimes, you know, the stories are right there, but unfortunately, oftentimes Western media or global North institutions don't always take the time to do the research and capture it. So for us, it was really about not our own ideas, although they are in the book. It's really about centering and chronicling what these women have achieved.
Great. So let me, Brooke, I want to go back to you and ask, you know, I started out talking about events from 10 years ago in the Arab Spring. And, you know, Megan is reminding us of the Me Too moment, which was like just a couple of years ago, right? And then we have a year ago, the rise, I mean, the rise of visibility for Black Lives Matter as a movement, as a hashtag on and offline. Tell us a little bit about how this, you know, quote, hashtag activism has evolved even since you've written the book.
Great question. So there are a few different ways that I could, you know, start to tackle that question. So first, one of the things I like to highlight for people is, you know, I think about the world in terms of networks, right? So each one of these movements, you know, arguably beginning with the kind of Arab Spring and the series of revolutions in that region, started to build networks. And we, just because of our habit of using social media, we tend to not unfollow people after an event, right? So we add people to our social media networks. We don't tend to prune them away. So when we think about these kinds of intersectional, you know, movements, they're not always the same people, but they also always have some people in common. And I think that's true even globally. So we start to stitch together these massive networks of folks who share the same general, you know, mission to create a more just and equitable society or societies around the world. So with that as the backdrop, we do see each subsequent movement tends to be a little bit bigger, and it tends to come together a little bit faster. And that's in part because of those networks and in part because we really develop strategies, right? So I think Megan's work highlights this really beautifully. But there are some people who either just have a knack for these things or have learned over time the strategies that work to get something to trend, to get the attention of a political leader or to demand a response from the media. And so we start to see these same strategies coming up again and again. So those things, you know, when people say, you know, how did it come, you know, sort of out of nowhere, these like millions and millions of people talking about George Floyd last summer, it's like, it was not. I mean, that is, you know, 15 years worth of work by activists stitching together the backdrop and the kind of affect and the language in order for people to be able to participate. And that was the moment where it came together. You know, the other thing I'll say about this is, of course, as soon as we, you know, any marginalized group starts to have some inroads to power, you get the backlash. So I think a lot of what we see going on in the US, just even, you know, today, around all these critical race scholarship bans and things like that, are really, you know, an acknowledgement on some deep level that we are making inroads, we are changing the dialogue. And so these backlashes feel scary, but also I think are a signal of a little bit of a gain in power over the last few years.
So I want to come back to the backlash, but first, Megan, if you can say a bit more, I had to just Google to look up. It was really 2017, I think, when the Me Too movement took off. And I recall writing a piece on sort of the global spread that got picked up by Newsweek. And I mean, it's amazing how quickly this spread internationally, right? So we're talking about at home and abroad today, and also just the complexities of how, you know, on the one hand, there, you know, Tarana Burke, Black woman, 10 years prior to Me Too becoming a hashtag, sort of comes up with this phrase, Me Too, and it gets, you know, taken up by celebrities and distributed globally. It's like it got, you know, both taken up and then, you know, drawn down in different ways, you know, in different countries and different languages, as you're explaining. Can you say a bit more about, you know, the evolution of the Me Too movement and what that tells us about both, you know, local empowerment, even as it magnifies the power of, you know, working collectively across difference?
Yeah, well, I have to shout out Tarana Burke and just expect deep gratitude because she wrote the foreword to our book. And we actually had this really beautiful, powerful conversation, which is just like a thrill when you're doing research. You're like, oh, I actually found something meaningful in my field work. Thank God, you know, but we were sharing with Tarana some of the stories, you know, from women in Nigeria, Tunisia, Egypt, women in Brazil, in China, in Pakistan, who all credited her by name. You know, from what, like you just described, an interaction when she was a community organizer and camp counselor in Selma, Alabama. I was talking to a young woman who confided in her about her own sexual assault. And Tarana says very, very plainly and very transparently in that moment, you know, she didn't have the strength to say Me Too, but as she walked away, she said it to herself, Me Too, right? So, you know, a lot of the countries where we wrote about, women are pushed out of, deliberately kept out of public spaces and places of influence where you got to hang out to organize, right? And change things. So those could be legislatures, they could be places of business, they can be media outlets. I mean, these are places where women are not employed, not elected, not allowed, either because of poverty, cultural expectations, or other constraints, like kept out. So what does social media allow? It allows for women to have individual grievances that get airtime and space that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise because they don't have the influence, the power, or access to capital to, you know, be able to put these messages out there. They find out that these grievances are collective instead of individual, right? So certain perpetrators who could be like in Tunisia, you know, an elected member of parliament, that name starts coming up, and then other women go, wait a minute, I've also had the same experience, and they start to get together, and then it becomes a formal, you know, action to try to call for justice in terms of should this person really be in elected office or not, you know. But I think there's a confusion sometimes when people see things as trending, right? Trending is really powerful. Big numbers are really powerful. But the other power of digital organizing, particularly of Twitter, is hyper-localization, right? It's like how I can dig into Twitter and with the right hashtag, find my weird hobby or that like way out there news story that I'm tracking, you know, and I can find everyone else around the world who's talking about it. I can even find journalists maybe tweeting from the scene of something that's happening in real time before they even file a story. You know, and so with the hyper-localization of it, you know, you can look at what the numbers are trending from 2017 to today, but I guarantee if you took a hot minute and dug in the right languages or did a media landscaping, you would see that there are still stories constantly popping up. And we've seen that even when we were writing the book, I was figuring out what to do because there was another outbreak of like Me Too activity and organizing in Egypt, but I had already written my Egypt chapter, you know? And so we finally had to just say, okay, we're drawing a line in the sand because this is still continuing in such a powerful way. You may just not hear about it in Western media. And I would argue it deserves more attention because some of the laws, the practices, the economic disenfranchisement, the human rights issues that these women are pushing back against are so deep and so profound that these victories really deserve to be celebrated, chronicled, and I would argue funded, not just to inspire us or do some studying, you know, about, but to actually then give them the resources they need because they're doing so much with so little. And all the data shows that locally led movements by women are one of the best investments you can make. But yet to this day, you know, they get less than one penny of every dollar of foreign aid. So that's the hope, is that seeing what they've done will lead to increased investment and policy changes that matter.
So I want to, I hope we can talk more about the global and the local and the intersections of, you know, Black Twitter, feminist Twitter, you know, Say Her Name, that movement is a good example of that. But Brooke, let's come back to what we might think of as the backlash, and also how these strategies have been taken up by the alt-right, right? So, I mean, hashtag activism is sort of a neutral term in the sense they can be used by anybody, right? Can you talk a bit about that as well?
Yeah, so two things come to mind. First, over time, we, of course, see direct interference inside otherwise progressive movements. So we know now, after the fact, for example, that there were state actors from Russia interfering in Black Lives Matter networks in order to sort of amplify discontent. The tricky thing, and I think the thing I always like to lift up when people talk about this, is that what those actors were doing inside the networks was not spreading lies, right? So there is an important, you know, misinformation narrative that we could explore here, but what they were doing was reminding people of hard truths, right? So if you want to make a Black American feel disenfranchised, reminding them of all the ways in which they are in fact disenfranchised by the government might be pretty effective, right? So you know, I think that is, although obviously there are some sort of foreign policy solutions there, that is also a reckoning with ourselves, right? So us in the US, and I'm pointing to myself, a white woman in particular, really need to do some work if we are in fact concerned about this, which we should be, to kind of reconcile within and amongst ourselves and with our Black friends and neighbors. So removing that as a possible weapon may be more effective than trying to shut it down entirely. The other thing I've noticed, and particularly since Trump lost the election, is the co-option of marginalization as a kind of white male strategy, right? So to talk about how they are marginalized, which, you know, there's no way you could sort of cut the data to make white men in America marginalized. And yet co-opting that and forcing folks to argue why they aren't marginalized rather than kind of focusing on the issues of actual marginalization and actual calls for justice seems to be increasingly effective. So it's hard. I think particularly for progressive minded folks, we are sensitive to critiques around marginalization and we want to address them. And so when conservative white men start to adopt that language, it becomes very tricky for us to untangle that even in our own brains and kind of do the mental gymnastics to figure out where to meet them and engage with those kinds of critiques. So I'm seeing more and more folks, even on Twitter, kind of getting into these dialogues, trying to explain what marginalization is and how we might measure it, which I'm not sure is actually an effective use of activist time.
Well, there is, you know, certainly economic anxiety that white men share with, you know, other people who have economic, you know, precarity, right, and their jobs and or lack of employment. And so, I mean, it seems that social media, first of all, we have epistemic bubbles that sort of divide us into these different, you know, sort of bubbles of knowledge, right, where which is filtered through cable news, but also through social media, whether we're on Parler or, you know, whatever our sources of news and information are. And so rather than economic anxiety as a way of bringing people together across difference, you know, social media can divide or be used to divide, right? And so that in part fuels the backlash as well. Megan, let me ask you about backlash against women who became champions of using, you know, social media and, you know, promoting a digital revolution around gender equality. What kinds of backlash have women faced in that context?
You know, the backlash feedback that you can hear, and I really want to uplift everything that Brooke already said. I'm just like nodding enthusiastically. I saw some snaps earlier, you know, and I give you those as well. But it's it's really something I think that like the whataboutism kind of, you know, people are like, well, what about, you know, the backlash, you know, and my response is just a smile and say, please present to me the social change movement that was successful where there was no backlash. You know, it's like people are like, oh, you want to end apartheid? Fantastic. Let's go ahead and do that, you know, or desegregation in the United States, you know, any civil rights issue, any women's rights issue. You know, there was never a time where people were like, we totally appreciate you coming in the way that we asked you to, and we will now agree to give up power. This sounds like a great exchange. Thank you so much. You know, like that has never happened. It's never happened. You know, so there, yeah, there's backlash. There's backlash. You know, I think the question is, are the people who are instigating these movements willing to experience what that backlash is? And a lot of them are. That doesn't mean that it excuses it. You know, there need to be better protections for threats of violence and, you know, all kinds of things that happen to target women online, you know, but most of the women we interviewed for the book, like I think of activists like Nigat Dad in Pakistan. I mean, she was already being harassed online and in real time, you know, for all the work that she was doing in legal courts to try to reform laws pertaining to women and women's rights. So she's like, yeah, there's backlash. You know why? Because we're making progress and that feels threatening. And so like, we should expect it. I see it as a marker of success that it's starting to change the public dialogue and that people are pushing back and rebelling against it, not as evidence that the movement or the tools aren't working. You know, sometimes peace needs to be disturbed for change. I think we know this. So I see the backlash as progress, and most of the activists I talk to do as well, but I don't want to minimize at all the serious price that all of them face. You know, for many of these women, it's not just their reputation, it's their livelihood and very frequently their lives, you know, and not just online threats, physical threats in real time in their real lives as well. You know, but many of the activists I work with kind of hit a point of decision where they decide, like, you know, either I stay silent or I keep speaking, and I'm deciding to move forward, you know. And I think we all know women, you know, whether it's Marielle Franco or others who have paid for this work with their lives. So the work is serious. So I take the backlash and the physical threats manifesting in real time very seriously, but not as evidence that the movement's not successful or should stop.
So let me ask each of you one more question, then we're going to go to the audience. So audience members, get ready with your questions. It feels like on the one hand, organizing online, it can pose a threat, right, to people in power, whether that's government leaders or, you know, other people in power. It's disruptive, right? I hosted Valerie Jarrett in a roundtable back when we were able to meet in person a couple years ago. And, you know, she kept coming back to the word disruption, right? And how organizing, whether on or offline, is disruptive. Technology can be disruptive socially, culturally, politically, economically. But Brooke, tell us about the threats to online, I mean, to social movement organizing online, and what should we be attuned to? And in a minute, I'm going to come to Megan about policy solutions, but tell us about some of those threats to organizing online.
So in the afterword to the book, I wrote a great deal about net neutrality, which seems, I think, to, well, probably not this audience, but to many people, this sort of like boring esoteric and network thing that like, who cares as long as I can get my Netflix, right? And but in this case, you know, I mean, the success or failure of these movements, I think the activists and those of us who study it are hyper aware that it rests on the goodwill of a handful of private organizations. And so far, the organizations have, by and large, supported it. I mean, I think there are, we could have conversations, you know, if you work at Twitter, but I have ideas. But by and large, there's support. And you even cited the example of sort of not closing down Twitter during the Iranian uprisings, right? So there have been specific losses that these organizations have taken. But it is troubling that at any given moment that could change. I mean, you know, that doesn't have to always exist. And particularly when we think about, you know, even dialing back some of the scant policy level protections that we have, like net neutrality, it starts to get really scary. You know, what if one day Twitter or Facebook or Google, which owns YouTube, just decides that like, they no longer want to be in the business of promoting social justice movements? They could turn it off, right? Or they could start charging us more to access it. So one might imagine you know, all sorts of ways and chaos that could ensue if we continue down this path. So, you know, I don't have great policy level solutions, but the kind of techno-libertarianism that pervades the current set suite of internet policies does not seem to me to be viable in the long run. If what we want to do is empower these disenfranchised or marginalized folks to come together, to have at least an avenue to kind of reclaim a bit of power and to find one another and organize together.
So Megan, what about potential policy solutions, either by governments, by multilateral regimes, by tech companies themselves, and the variety of stakeholders? Thoughts about that, and then we'll turn to the audience next.
So good. I think of it in terms of how is the organizing influencing policy that impacts these women and their communities and the issues they're organizing around. And I love when you mentioned, say, her name earlier in this discussion of Black Lives Matter. Literally every activist that I've talked to has talked about, you know, you find this cross, like transnational energy between the organizing that happened in the United States, not around just Me Too, but also around Black Lives Matter and racial justice, has absolutely inspired other disenfranchised groups in other countries, sometimes because of the tragic and toxic legacy of colonialism in terms of colorism. You know, their community is disenfranchised. Like I think about the Afro-Brazilian community in Brazil, especially under Bolsonaro and his statements about people of color and particularly women of color, you know, but also in other communities where specific groups are disenfranchised because of faith beliefs or because of tribal conflicts, you know, and so they've been able to really bring visibility and take a lot of inspiration. You know, I think about one name like that's influenced policy, I think is Lujain Al-Hathloul. I started seeing hashtags with Lujain's name. Who's Lujain? If you're not familiar with her, she's a woman who is campaigning for women's rights in Saudi Arabia, you know, and including the right to drive. And, you know, very conveniently after MBS announced that women's rights would be starting to shift because he was so progressive, then he immediately actually imprisoned the very women who he saw as a threat who were campaigning for these rights. Someone like Lujain, her case would not have gotten anywhere near the amount of public attention without a tool like Twitter. It simply wouldn't have. It would have been something that maybe very specific human rights groups would try to advocate for. But because of Twitter, her family, her brother Waleed and her sister Lena, who, by the way, you know, live in different countries, have been able to digitally organize every single day to keep a spotlight on her freedom, so that now when people are discussing Saudi policy in the US relationship, you know, we have specific people that we've humanized and stories that we know of injustice and human rights that we can start to have a conversation about, like, hey, maybe we need to reassess some of the factors around this relationship. I see that also in terms of policy with Egypt, in terms of our military aid that we give to that country, how we work together. You know, I was heartened to see, you know, Secretary of State Tony Blinken mention specific imprisoned activists in his press availabilities, because people have been doing what? Campaigning on Twitter around the freedom of those political prisoners. You know, ultimately, what I hope will come is this shift in investing in local women's organizations and activists for the issues that they're campaigning about, right? You know, just as Rosa Parks, in terms of the civil rights era, you know, bus boycott was not just about a seat on a bus, you know, it was about a larger system of injustice. Me Too actually touches on a larger system of injustice that women experience beyond sexual assault and harassment, which are full stop human rights violations, but it touches this larger legal, economic, political question of equality, right? So the women who are part, like Brooke said, of these movements tend to be part of other movements as well. And like you saw that in Egypt, women who are part of the uprisings, part of trying to recraft their constitution to be sensitive to gender and guarantee the equality of men and women in this hoped for new, you know, new life in the country, are now the very people that the Sisi regime is, you know, suppressing. And these are feminist organizers who continue to take on Me Too cases. You know, women like Aza Salomon and Mohsen Hassan, you know, continue to be subjugated, you know. And so I think in terms of policy, we need to start linking, because of some of these campaigns, how are we interacting with repressive regimes that are repressing women activists? Is this a question that should start coming up more when we talk about aid, whether it's military aid or international aid, how we work together? And then how can we change our policy in the US for how we fund international development? Too much of USAID's funding still goes to contractors. They have to move billions of dollars every year through appropriations. Is there a way to further and accelerate efforts under the Biden administration to make sure that women's organizations are getting the funding they need?
Fantastic. So let's, I want to leave time for discussion with the audience, because I was just looking at the list of participants and we have a fantastic Zoom room of participants. We see you, okay? I'm going to ask Erica to remind us the instruction for how folks can raise their digital hands, and then we'll turn to your questions.
Go ahead. Absolutely. Go ahead, Erica. As a reminder, to ask a question, please click on the raise hand icon on your Zoom window. When you are called on, please accept the unmute now prompt, then proceed with your name and affiliation followed by your question.
Thank you, Erica. Over to you, audience, looking to you for your questions, just raise your digital hand. And let me just say, I had hoped to have somebody from the Global South in our conversation today, but we weren't able to pull that off. So hopefully down the road, we'll be able to do that. One of the benefits of being virtual is that it makes it a bit easier to get folks who can't travel, even while we still have time differences. So while we're waiting for folks to raise their digital hands, I did want to ask about the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. And Kamari Clark, who's a wonderful anthropologist at UCLA, has written about the complexities of Bring Back Our Girls, right? Which many celebrities got involved in, Michelle Obama, others similar to Me Too. But you know, one question she raises is, do some of these hashtag activism campaigns, does it say more about us in the West or in the North than it does about them in the Global South, right? So with Bring Back Our Girls, you know, how much of this was really about addressing the underlying causes that, you know, led to Boko Haram, you know, threatening girls not to participate not in school, and ultimately the kidnapping of the Chibok girls. So that's a particular complexity of global digital organizing about, you know, who has power, who gets to speak and who gets heard. So I'll throw that out there while I'm also looking at the participants list to see if anyone wants from the audience wants to raise their hand. But while we're waiting for that, do the two of you have thoughts about that, the sort of power dynamic between North and South when it comes to digital organizing?
All right, I see Brooke gesturing to me. You know, I'd say that the first place to start is ask the people themselves, right? You know, it's like and to take with a grain of salt, digital organizing is not an end unto itself. I had a colleague I was working with on trying to call attention to a humanitarian crisis. And we were laughing about like, we should do a fake PSA where like a food drop plane from World Food Program is like flying over where there's a famine. Instead of pushing out food deliveries, they're pushing out Facebook likes, you know, and like Twitter retweets, you know. So like, I think sometimes that's like, the approach people take, like if it trends, if it's a big deal online, we've won, we've done the thing. No, it's one tool in organizing, just like media is, just like government outreach is. You know, I think it's a complex issue. And I think we need to look at the context and listen to the people themselves. In terms of Bring Back Our Girls, I do think that social media brought unprecedented attention to what happened to those young women in Chibok. I also think of my former boss, Malala Yousafzai. You know, I don't know if a 15-year-old girl being shot by the Taliban for going to school would have gotten so much attention if we hadn't been in the social media age, and also had young people her age online who were, you know, connecting with her story and wanting to see justice. You know, I don't know if those families and their suffering of losing their daughters, some of whom returned, some of still have not, you know, would have gotten the global attention it did. I can speak to Malala at the time when I worked for her. We planned a trip for her to go to Nigeria, and she actually went to meet with the families. And it was in that meeting, which was spurned by learning about their story through social media. The family said that Goodluck Jonathan, the then president, hadn't even taken time to meet with them. She was scheduled to meet with Goodluck Jonathan over the coming days, and she raised their case with him. Do we pretend that this solved everything? Not at all. But I think this is the hard work of advocacy and activism. You know, it is an art and not a science, right? You know, and so you can throw everything that you've got at it and you still may not get the justice you hope for, which in this case would have been the safe return of these young women and the services that they needed, some of which they did receive as a result of the overarching campaign. You know, I would just close by saying the women that I interviewed for the book in Nigeria who organized the Ariwa Me Too campaign live exactly where Boko Haram is most active, right? And I think this is something that sometimes folks in the West or the North can get confused about. They think if an area is experiencing conflict or terrorism, that people in that community aren't just kind of going on with their lives to the best of their ability. They are. And so in fact, terrorism is not the only thing happening in that community. There's also issues around women's rights and education. And so somehow these women under great threat from own community norms and also terrorism were campaigning around Ariwa Me Too and very visibly so. You know, and experienced actually more threats from other people in their community than they did from Boko Haram, you know, accusing them of being lesbians, accusing them of being westernized, you know, not knowing their place or not being good Muslim women. And they, you know, were more than happy to have that conversation as devoted Muslims about what they believe their faith teaches about their rights. But you know, I think it's a complex issue. And I think this is something that's endemic of all digital discussion. It's really easy to have a surface discussion. And guess what? Just like real-time life, it's super messy. And it takes a lot to untangle what's really going on in terms of causality, especially.
So let's, I want to go to Eric, whose hand is raised. And I also, if either of you have questions for each other, I want to leave time for that. Eric, please take the floor.
Thank you so much for this great presentation, Megan and Brooke. My question is about sort of more threats to online organizing. We've touched on two different parts of that so far, you know, threats from backlash of, you know, just other people on Twitter. We've also talked about companies, you know, whether they are, how committed they are to maintaining the discussion. But I'm wondering about threats from governments themselves. Like I'm thinking, I've been tracking, you know, India recently raided the Twitter offices, you know, sent police to sort of crush and threaten the platform from promoting, you know, the political opposition. So in your research, how concerned have you become about authoritarian governments specifically targeting the social media platforms themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I will speak even within a US context, right? That's not, you don't need to be in an authoritarian regime to have some concerns about surveillance. You know, anyone who's challenging power is sort of necessarily going to raise the ire of people in power. And so we heard, particularly from Black activists, all kinds of interesting strategies to be able to communicate without specifically revealing who they were or where they were, particularly during active protests and so on. There's one young man who we don't name in the book and was the most prolific tweeter during the Ferguson protests. But would routinely just dump his whole account, right? So he would scrub every tweet. And we took that as a signal. We never even reached out to him directly, but we took that as a signal, obviously, that he was trying to evade detection. And we subsequently learned from people who did know him and interact with him that that was exactly what he was doing. He was live streaming the protests, but didn't want to tip off the police to exactly who he was, because he was sometimes in places where the police could use laws like anti-trespassing laws or anti-loitering laws to detain him. So that's a real risk, even in democratic countries, and you know, a risk that is obviously magnified in places where the government might use more oppressive tools in order to suppress these kinds of uprisings.
I'll just add on. I mean, if you want some comedy, watch some of the, you know, Hill hearings about social media, like when members of Congress are kind of, you know, grandstanding about like the use of social media, which, by the way, like all their offices are using, you know, very, very deliberately, you know, or like making demands of the wrong platform to change things on a different platform, you know, and you're like, wow, these are the folks like holding the reins on the law pertaining to something that seems pretty important. You know, you don't have dissimilar conversations. I just want to uplift what Brooke said in the US than you do in other countries. Yeah, it's a tool of authoritarian regimes to monitor, suppress, intercept disinformation. Absolutely. But, you know, I then always say when people raise an alarm about something in the digital space, like, huh, is there an analog real-time comparison? And yeah, like try being a journalist in a repressive regime at any time, you know, over the last 50 years, especially during a time of conflict. You know, I think the example of the Modi regime raiding the Twitter offices for people daring to communicate honestly about incredible suffering their families were facing from the COVID pandemic is a really interesting example that even folks that the US considers large democracies and good friends, you know, will use these tools as well. You know, you can also see in some of the organizing in, you know, former Soviet republics, you know, that are now free and having all kinds of things happen. You know, but what I would say is that, you know, these folks are so creative and like the generational differential is huge. Like if you need to call your nephew to explain to you like how to get on the Twitters, you know, like God, man, you should call one of these activists because like they will tell you everything that they do, you know, in terms of VPN technology, like all kinds of tools, you know. And I will say, you know, I've been at human rights conferences actually where there's specific units at companies like Twitter that actually come and brief human rights activists from all over the world and tell them about specific tools that they can use to try to communicate, you know, and this is information I'll give to anybody, but, you know, even where there may be actions by a part of a company that are reprehensible, I do find there are often people that really believe in some of these rights and this kind of communication and activity, you know, that should be lawful political organizing, you know, that are trying to be helpful. And by the way, every human rights activist I know has somebody that they call at Twitter or Facebook when things get wacky, you know, to ask for help when their accounts get taken over or frozen by their regimes, you know. So there are people at these companies, despite larger policies, that do try to help.
So yeah, I was actually wanted to ask really about the tech tools that can be used, whether it's sort of end-to-end, you know, encryption for more confidential, you know, communication and organizing, especially under regimes where people may be under threat of arrest. But also, I mean, what about that, Megan, with I know there are sort of like human rights positions now at various tech companies, but is that the sort of go-to person for an activist to figure out how to gain protection? Do either of you know anything about that space? And also, you know, I know there are people in the audience who are with tech companies, so would welcome any input from folks who have expertise. So either on the tech side or the sort of political you know, an organizing side, what role can tech companies themselves play to support online organizing?
I would love to hear if there's folks in the audience from some of the companies. I'm sure they're limited by what they can share, but if there's things that they feel like they feel comfortable sharing in this relevant space, that would be fantastic. You know, I think that, you know, in terms of technology, it's kind of like the same thing as COVID. Did you ever see that, the diagram with the Swiss cheese approach, you know, to like, you know, it's like, if you wash your hands and wear a mask and are 6 feet apart and don't stay inside an unventilated space, you know, if we do all these things, you have a better chance. It's the same thing with tech, you know, it's everything that's practical from like not going to meet with other activists with phones that have SIM cards that can be, you know, geo-targeted. It's like, oh, hey, we can see that all of you are meeting, to, you know, making sure using, it's amazing how many people don't even use two-factor authentication. You know, it's like, use that, VPNs, using, you know, all kinds of creative tools and ways to try to communicate online, you know. But sometimes, you know, you really, most human rights activists I know, some of them actually do very little to protect their communication because they've just decided that they're going to accept whatever the consequences are of their organizing. And so they actually just do it out in the open, which is a pretty powerful position to take at a great personal peril. There's no perfection. There's no perfect system. I mean, I think we can see that with all the resources of the US government in terms of some of the hacks they've experienced, right? Like, could they have any more money or expertise to draw upon? And even they can't keep their systems safe. I continue to get letters from OPM that because I was a reference for somebody on their security clearance, that my accounts could still be compromised, you know? So there's no perfection. But I think this generational piece of people that are tech native is really, really vital. Like, people are incredibly creative about finding ways.
That's for sure. My son is teaching me every day, you know, it's all on Snapchat, not LinkedIn. I love LinkedIn myself. Okay. Not to, you know, push back on that. So let's go to I see Carolyn Hayes' hand raised. I'd like to go to her.
Hi. Yes. I was wondering if throughout your research, you came across the phenomenon of identities being sort of transported across languages and cultures through social media, specifically thinking about LGBTQ identities and like how the way that we define the self is kind of shifting throughout the age of Twitter. And maybe even if you came across in your research in Egypt, post the Queen Boat incident in 2001, how that affected people's relationship expressing themselves on social media. If you have any insight into that, that would be great.
Brooke or Megan?
Brooke, do you want to start?
No.
She's passing. Okay. I want to be deferential to my esteemed colleague who has way more degrees than I have. I would just say yes, 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 and yes. And like, actually that was something that was really surprising and heartening to me in doing my book field research, was how much, because of digital organizing, the traditional feminist community has actually joined in kind of a sense of joint struggle in the face of great peril and crackdown with the LGBTQ I community all over the world. You know, in Tunisia, this has been a huge place. Like every feminist organizer I met, and you think back to like Ben Ali, and you know, it's only been 10 years since that uprising. And you know, in Tunisia, which is such a success story in terms of some of these issues compared to Egypt, who they absolutely looked up to in terms of the uprisings and the revolutions in 2011. You know, it's become really a shared struggle, and the visibility becomes really powerful to see online. You know, and so even women in Tunisia, they did a protest in front of parliament to protest this member of parliament who was sexually harassing and sexually inappropriate and assaulted a young woman who was underage, who was a student in Tunisia. And so they actually did the Chilean the Rapist Is You performance in Tunisian Arabic in front, which is another like incredible digital organizing kind of ping-ponging around the world. Many women of Lates, it's the Chilean collective, are LGBTQ women, and so there were actually visibly LGBTQ members of those communities who are part of that. And then it was designed for social, you know, it was designed for press that came and then social media, and they were proudly standing together. I think of Pakistan, a lot of the women who organized around Me Too and around women's rights, they started after the Women's March in the United States that same year, an Arat March, which is just woman in Urdu. So it was the Arat, the Women's March, and invited the LGBT community to come march with them, which is only putting in that context an even bigger bullseye on them to be targeted by, you know, very conservative religious groups and just people that are like, you know, maybe I would have agreed with a woman has a right to work, but certainly not, you know, with this community. And they proudly marched together. And I have to say, like, I loved seeing photos of transgender members of the Pakistani community out marching, you know, with longtime women's activists and lawyers. Like, I think that solidarity has also come because of solidarity that's been fostered online, you know, because it's really about making people visible. And maybe they get found out, but sometimes they don't, you know, and they can actually start to speak out and just be like, hey, I am somebody who is also Egyptian, Tunisian, Pakistani, Nigerian, who's LGBT, and being able to speak about their experience and just say, hey, I'm here. Like, I'm here, I'm right here. And you're gonna have to start to listen about what I need in terms of my human rights. But I wanna salute these activists because obviously these issues put them at tremendous personal peril, right up to and including losing their lives for being out and for speaking out. So it's been really interesting to see. Because I mean, frankly, just like the women's suffragette movement threw under the bus and sold out the Black women who were campaigning right against them so that the white suffragists, you know, could advocate for themselves. In the past, there's been a lot of, you know, feminist organizations that would not caucus with the LGBT community, you know, for that very reason. They're like, you're going to drag us down with these people. So we can't do this. And I've seen a huge shift, which is so heartening and overdue.
So
just echo that, that even in the US context, we see again and again, these movements of a variety of stripes are led by Black queer women. And on account of that, we are constantly, even when there's a little shift away, constantly being asked to reconsider and recenter Black queer women in particular in these movements, which has really strengthened the coalitions overall.
I thought I saw one more hand up, but now the hand is down. So, I think this is, I wanna give you both a chance for any closing thoughts. And just on this last point about queer organizing and also, you know, intersectional organizing. I mean, I was really struck last year with the way in which LGBTQI issues came to the fore in the context of Black Lives Matter. Recall in New York City, there was that, I think it was Black Trans Lives Matter in Brooklyn. And really, you know, I mean, that was, you know, offline as but on and offline. And the way in which Black Lives Matter brought together so many different intersections of issues was really powerful. Let me just, in the few minutes that remain, give you any moments for final thoughts, and including if you have questions for each other, but just any concluding thoughts. Why don't we go to Brooke first?
Yes. Well, first of all, Megan, I'm definitely going to follow up because I have a zillion questions. So thank you for your insights. I would love to track a little more closely some of those ways in which, you know, it's my impression, having focused mostly on the US, but we trace where the messages end up and where they come from sometimes, that there is this really sort of like volleying that's happening back and forth, and that the movements are building on one another. You know, and if I had to highlight something that feels pretty new about this era of activism, that would be it. The kind of global messaging that can happen more or less instantaneously. I mean, we just lacked the media infrastructure to do that in the past. And to the extent that those, you know, all of our destinies are kind of tied up with each other, that feels like a really powerful and worldwide opportunity for change. So I feel excited about that. You know, the last thing I will say is that our research on this and our ability to teach on this and our ability to kind of empower community activists is so very much dependent on the social media companies and the platform's cooperations. And I, you know, I see some places leaning into cooperating and other places backing away. So for those of you who are in these tech companies, to the extent that you're able to even, you know, even if you can't share everything or even if you can't disclose how everything works, that you're able to find avenues and really build this in to the business model. I think that is incredibly important, not only for these organizations, but also for all of us in humanity. So I'll end there.
Megan.
Thank you so much for what Brooke just shared. You know, I'd say like the point of all this organizing is not just awareness. I'm always very suspicious of awareness. I'm like, awareness is an input. It's not it doesn't cause anything necessarily until it does. And you know, there's an art, again, in a science, and the art means like you throw a lot of stuff at something, including awareness, but it's not an end into itself, right? So, you know, I think in terms of like, okay, great, we've talked about this, but what does it mean for us today where we find ourselves right now? So, you know, this is an incredibly influential group of folks. I would say, you know, if you're coming to council events, like do a quick Twitter search with some hashtags that are relevant to that country. You might find some very interesting issues that folks are talking about that are not covered in the mainstream media that would prep you for some very interesting questions to some of these governments leaders and, you know, other foreign leaders that we're privileged to have come speak and share, you know, at the Council on Foreign Relations. You know what, I would also say, like, please raise, you know, things like funding for women's organizations and whatever spaces you can. I looked at the list and there's amazing people working on these issues already. So I know in my own context, we would say we're preaching to the choir, but like keep singing. You know, I think a lot of people don't know that we spend this 1% number on women's organizations. There's a sense, because we talk about girls and women and organizing and hooray for girls and hooray for women, you know, that this is happening and like the numbers just aren't there. And what is policy about? It's about priorities, laws, and money, cash, money, show me the money. So like we need to shift how we fund, you know, women's organizations, because the number is way too low. So have those conversations, you know, and then I would just say continue to change this community in terms of CFR. It's great to talk about this, but I would say vote with your feet. So like, please keep coming to events, chaired by incredible colleagues who are women of color and who are experts and esteemed academics. And, you know, I hope that institutions like the council will reflect some of this organizing by continuing to expand the number of fellows of color that we have. I was so thrilled to see, for example, there was an LGBT, you know, leaders in the space and national security list, and our colleague Paul Angelo was part of that list. So how wonderful that we can continue to build this, you know, beloved community that we say we believe in, you know. So I hope that our institution will continue to take this on. And that all of our membership will continue to support those efforts. It's really important. You know, if you go to an event and don't see diversity, let someone know. You know, if you have a great speaker, please let us know who they are, so that we can make sure that we hear from them and hopefully take action.
I want to thank all of you, including members of our advisory committee. I see Jill Iskol, and I'm sorry we're out of time now to take additional questions. But I do want to say, you know, we think of this space as being sort of the digital town square, right? And yet, I think it's easy for us to tweet and then sort of sit back and, you know, we've done our job. You know. Hashtag Black Lives Matter, right? Hashtag Me Too. And it may take the onus off of us to get out on the street and organize. But, you know, at the same time, even though we think of a tweet as small, you know, the accumulation of all of our individual small acts can go viral. And so I hope we can continue this conversation. We're in the Zoom room, we can't then chat with each other outside the Zoom room once this event is over, as we used to be able to do when we were all in person. But I do hope we can continue this conversation to figure out how we take our small acts online, offline, to really build power to address these important social justice issues. So once again, I want to thank Brooke and Megan and all of you for joining us in the Zoom room, and hope to see you outside the Zoom room very soon. Thank you again.
For more event audio, subscribe on iTunes or visit us at cfr.org.